have to make a correction in the opening brief and the reply brief. I cite the Emmeline case about 47 times, and of course, as this court knows, that opinion was withdrawn, the July opinion in Emmeline. And there, a new opinion was entered by the same panel on a motion for reconsideration or rehearing in February, which I call Emmeline 2. So the issue involving Blakely and Booker and Fenfen and all
that. And that one's been vacated as well.
Well, yes, it has. I guess it's been deferred. I don't know if that's as bad as vacated, but it's been deferred because 14...
It's probably what we call shifting sands to a lot of them.
Well, one of the interesting facts is that the petition for rehearing in bank in that case was joined by 14 of the U.S. attorneys,
you know,
in the Ninth Circuit.
I think to save you as much of your 20 minutes as we can...
Uh-huh.
Just skip over the Emmeline issue.
Okay, I just wanted
to... Emmeline is pending in bank.
I assume this court knows that it's pending in bank, and I just wanted to point that out because I cited it a whole bunch
of
times.
I've heard of it.
Okay.
I've heard of it. All
right.
We will not decide any of the Emmeline questions. I can say that with authority until the Emmeline opinion in bank thing comes out.
All right.
Anything Emmeline related in this case, you can just skip over.
All right. Let me ask the court. There is a question being raised as to whether or not... the defendant admitted the facts of the sentencing. That's not a matter of the Emmeline case. Those are facts. That's pursuant to this case.
I think you probably should pursue because
that's what I thought.
That is because, of course, if
yes.
you admitted it, there's no.
That's right.
There's no Emmeline issue at all.
Okay, so briefly address.
So up to there you should go. What happens if it's a disputed fact?
Right.
Then that's something that Emily will tell us, and I have no idea what it will say.
Okay, well, what counsel is referring to in the answering brief is a couple of footnotes or references in Emmeline, which shouldn't be cited, that referred to the fact that in order to take advantage of the Sixth Amendment argument, you've got to establish that you did not admit the facts underlying the enhancements. And the counsel cites briefly to the trial record and says that the restraint and the vulnerable victim facts were admitted, and he gives some quotes. I have addressed that in a reply brief. I think the position that the defendant takes is that statements made at trial, unless they are dead on point, which, of course, none of those statements he made were, are not the issue in terms of admission. The admission focuses not on statements made during trial, but on statements made after the pre-sentence report is filed, and facts are alleged in that, which in this case it said restraint and vulnerable victim, and whether or not the defendant dissents and files an opposition saying, hey, we disagree with the pre-sentence report, those facts aren't true, and here's why. And again, at sentencing, when counsel shows up and says, we disagree with the PSR, and of course the prosecutor agrees with the PSR, then that's the question of whether or not it's disputed, not whether or not there's some way to take the facts at trial and argue that they constitute an admission. I'd also point out, and again, I don't want to repeat my reply brief, but when the government appeared in front of the sentencing judge, he had the opportunity at that time to say, hey, we don't need to dispute these two facts because they were conceded at trial. He did not say that in his papers or argue it below. He just invented that argument after we brought up the Emmeline issue. So we say that, you know, there really isn't any believable, credible argument that there were admissions. Unless there are questions, I'll move on to the other portions of the argument.
Why don't you go ahead and do that?
Obviously, the primary reason we're here on appeal is because of the issue of sexual innuendo and of turning a prosecution over protective order into what essentially was a child molestation case. There's a lot of confusion in the record. I do think that the government has raised some significant waiver issues. I think that there are some questions when you go through the record as to exactly what was objected to and when. I obviously am taking the position that overall the issue is squarely before this court. And I think probably the strongest reason that it is because of the verdict itself. This jury decided on the basis of 2262, this relatively new law, that the defendant boarded a plane in Texas with the intention of having an accidental meeting with this young boy in a Hawaii mall approaching him on his bicycle. And of course, we take the position that that allegation and that finding by the jury is so far-fetched that the reason this jury went the way they did is because of the sexual innuendos.
It's only far-fetched if you load the word accidental with all of its potential meaning of you know, totally unexpected. You know, for example, when I on my flight home, I'm in Honolulu Airport, and I ran into somebody I knew in high school for the first time in, I'm not going to say how many years, but many years. That would be accidental. But in this case, there is evidence in the record, I think, and you can correct me if I'm wrong about this, that he had spent, your client spent considerable time with Joshua while your client was in Hawaii and visiting, and he knew where the kid hung out, and it's not such a far-fetched
thing. Sorry, Your Honor, there's no evidence in the record that the defendant knew that this kid hung out at that mall. In fact, he was specifically asked during the direct examination whether or not he had ever been to the mall with Joshua, and said he had not. Now, Joshua was not asked that question, but there's no evidence in the record that the two of them ever went to the mall. That's simply
He does not have to have ever gone to the mall himself. Of course, he might have lied as well. It was, maybe I'm not saying the record is wrong, is that the mall was someplace where you could expect the kid to show up. And if you wanted to run into my boys, let's say, there are a few places that I could tell you for sure. You would easily find them if you hung out long enough. The Starbucks or the shopping mall. You know, so these things are not such a mystery. Or, you know, there's a local movie theater and sometimes they hang out there. So it's not such a mystery where teenage boys or teenage boys and girls, I guess, are likely to be run into. It's not like a random place. And this was, mall is not an unlikely place to, or the mall particularly near the house is not an unlikely place to accidentally run into somebody.
Well, I'm sorry.
Let's assume, I mean, you obviously argued that it was accidental.
Yeah, and the prosecutor didn't argue otherwise.
Take out all the, you know, the evidence with the prior young man.
Uh-huh.
It's you can't entirely excise the relationship the two have had, the exchange of emails, you know, all of that.
Certainly not.
But also, too, you can't excise what happened at the time of the contact. Now, if something were accidental, you know, which I'm sure, you know, if I were prosecuting this case, how I would argue it, is you know you're under a restraining order. You accidentally run into someone that you know you're not supposed to see. That evidence of it's accidental would be that you would leave at that point, as opposed to approaching the individual. Isn't there? I mean, that he testified that he grabbed onto the steering wheel or of his bike or something and tried to stop him and talk to him, right? There's no way he can, all of the other arguments that you make, you can always make the argument that it's accidental, but you can't immunize him from what the circumstances of the encounter were for the jury to decide.
That's correct. And he admitted that it was a violation to touch the handlebars.
You have to accept that a jury is probably going to look at it, if it were accidental, what would I do when I know I'm under a restraining order? I would then say, oh, I can't talk to you, and leave, as opposed to trying to pursue the contact further, grab onto the handlebars, and, you know, that type of thing.
I didn't argue that there was insufficient evidence, Your Honor, and I'm not arguing
well,
enough.
I guess it's all intertwined in terms of if you're assessing prejudice as well, in terms of, if you're looking at the prior that came in with the other young man, in terms of that there had been contact with this individual, I think it was 7 years previously,
right.
And there had, then let's just say that was error, that it wasn't similar enough or something along those. But, I mean, you still have to look at prejudice of any type of error.
I agree.
And really the most significant thing.
Which is why I made that statement.
What's the evidence of the encounter besides, you know, what's the evidence that we're not disputing? And he still, unfortunately, has some fairly damning evidence to overcome.
Well, I agree with all of that.
I mean, I'm just saying that honestly to give you an opportunity to make your best argument.
Yes. Okay. Let me say one more time, Your Honor. First of all, if you look at the not only the argument that the prosecutor made at the motion in limine, where he explained to the judge that he had to have the evidence of sexual intent in order to show intent. I mean, clearly that was his theory of the case, and he did not argue in his closing argument after the whole trial was over that somehow he intended to run into defendant at the shopping center. He never argued that. What he argued is that he had the intent in Texas to have some contact, not that particular contact, but some contact with a defendant, and that when he got to Hawaii, he in fact did have contact. He argued this statute in a very strange way, and if you look at the way
but
he describes the
so
statute,
he was persistent in trying to have contact with this young man, despite the parents saying, "I don't email my child, change the email address."
I agree.
And he still no, but I've got to,
yes.
You know, I've got to talk to him.
That's
and
clear.
He's how old?
The defendant is 36.
And 12.
Yes. Okay.
Yeah, and even the quote accidental contact at the mall. Joshua said, "I want to leave." The guy said, "I want to speak to you for 2 minutes." And he grabbed the handlebars to keep Joshua from leaving. So even if we assume you're correct, it was accidental. And along the same lines, when you assume that we agree the district court erred in allowing the Coes to testify that they feared McNeil might be a pedophile, how is your client prejudiced by this admission? Because his own email to the Coes, which was admitted as evidence, put the issue of whether the Coes believed he had sexual intentions toward their children.
Well, okay, that's sort of a two-part question, Your Honor. Let's start off with what the Coes said. The Coes did not say that he might be a pedophile. The Coes said they thought, after seeing boyglove.com, that he was a pedophile. That's a big step difference. The argument was not that there's a possibility the defendant is a pedophile. The argument was repeatedly that he is, all right? So, but assuming that all it was maybe he's a pedophile.
Even if they believed he is.
Well, that sounds like what the jury's being told is the Coes thought he was a pedophile.
You know, if you excise everything, when you have a 36-year-old man, you know, making this insistent, you know, contact with a 12-year-old, I can't believe that there would be anyone with an IQ above 50 that it wouldn't be crossing their mind that this person was, that they were a pedophile. So, you know, the prejudice is there by virtue of the by the behavior.
Well,
I appreciate your position. Yeah,
very strong objection to that statement, because I don't think that a 36-year-old hanging out with a 12-year-old is necessarily a pedophile. I mean, that's exactly the point we are making here.
Well,
I
didn't say that, but I mean, you kept emailing him. The parents said, "I don't want you."
Well, there's no sexual content whatsoever either. The child was asked if he ever had any sexual aggression by this man whatsoever, and he said he did not. There's no evidence in this record whatsoever that there was a sexual.
But you're forgetting, and you're leaving out the bookmark on his computer to boylove.com.
That's
a big component. If you're a parent and you had this of a teenage boy. And it'd be strange enough for a 36-year-old man to be wanting to spend a lot of time with. I mean, that alone, you know, maybe those of us who are from big cities have more suspicious minds about those things, but I sure think boy love might be involved, you know, something like that. But if he has a bookmark, you know, not just some website that he happens to have seen once, but something that he keeps as a bookmark on his computer, which means he goes back and sees it again and again, I think there would be little that could be done to convince me otherwise.
Well, the judge ruled in her order granting the motion in limine, Your Honor, that it was inappropriate and not inextricably connected, and also that it was highly prejudicial and violated 403. So you're sort of overruling her. I'd like to address Judge Nelson's question because I think it's a good one. I'm not saying your questions are not, but she did ask a question. We sort of moved on. She asked about the impact of the emails. I tried to address that in my reply brief, Judge, and the position that we take is those emails were not admitted into evidence until after the prosecutor's opening statement and the Coe's testimony. By the time that those emails were introduced, the defendant no longer took the position that they were inadmissible because those emails contained denials. Those emails and his testimony addressing these subjects all said, I have no sexual interest in this child. So those things came in afterwards. At the time that those were offered into evidence, the argument was already before the jury that boylove.com and the suggestion that he was a pedophile and the Taylor, all that stuff had already come in, been described in the opening statement, and even, by the way, described in the judge's so-called limiting instruction, where she outlined what the testimony the jury was going to hear was and mentioned Brandy and Devin Coe and mentioned boylove.com before they even heard it from the Coes, the judge said it. So all that was the cat out of the bag. And again, I understand this general perception in the community that maybe that when a 36-year-old hangs out with a 12-year-old obsessively, that he's a pedophile. You know, and that's exactly why this evidence was so dangerous and prejudicial in this case. As I pointed out in the opening brief, five or six jurors refused to serve because of that exact prejudice, Judge Callahan.
You want to exclude the evidence of the bookmark, but wasn't that in fact admitted?
I'm sorry, it was a favorites list. It wasn't a bookmark. It was a favorites list computer site.
Same thing again,
Your Honor, this judge ruled that it was inadmissible. She said that it should not be mentioned by name and that it was more prejudicial than probative, and it happened 2 years before this incident, and therefore it was irrelevant. That's what she said. She said 401, 403, and 404. Then she modified her ruling, and it's our position that the initial position she took was correct, but that when she dealt with it mid-trial and before the opening statements of the prosecutor, she changed her mind. Again, we're saying that the potential for prejudice in this case is huge.
I asked you a simple question. You mentioned, was the evidence of the bookmark or the favorite, whatever you want to call it, admitted before the jury?
The evidence of boylove.com being on the favorites list and causing them to think he was a pedophile was the first testimony out of the Coe's mouth. Yes, of course it was. It was stated not only by the judge, but also by the prosecutor.
Okay, fine. So you keep leaving it out in your discussion, your summary, as if it didn't exist. In fact, it was in front of the jury. So you're saying, it's not so strange to have a 36-year-old man hanging out with a 12-year-old boy obsessively. You know, I think it's pretty strange. I didn't say it was strange,
Your Honor. It's compulsive.
I realize it's suspicious. It's not the kind of thing I would want to have involved with any boy, you know, that I cared about, but but when you add this additional fact that this guy goes on the internet and looks at, I don't know what's on boylove.com, but I can imagine there are not a lot of
Bandy
cartoons on there, huh?
You just made my point. The jury imagined. You can't imagine, but the jury imagined. The jury filled in all the blanks. You don't, once you give the name of the website and you ask the complaining witnesses what they thought after they saw it, and they say that he was a pedophile.
I must confess, I did not go check it out.
I did not go check it out,
but, maybe you should have.
But you don't need to, Your Honor. That's
the
point.
a bunch of Bambi, you know, things that boys love to play with, like G.I. Joe or something. If that's what it is, it seems to me that's evidence.
Well, let's go back to what he was charged with, Your Honor.
But the reality is, boylove.com is probably exactly what it seems to be, which is probably a website involving.
I would like to go back to my question
and make. I realize you're having a hard time here.
Yes,
trying to get a word in.
But yes, strong feelings about this case.
Let me just say, the name of the website was entered into evidence on two other occasions, neither of which you challenged. McNeil used the name of the website in his May 27, 2002 email to the Coes, and the name of the website was also discussed during McNeil's May 22, 2002 conversation with Kathy Coe, which was recorded and played to the jury. And there was no objection at that time. So why is that so prejudicial then?
Well, I'm sorry, Judge Nelson. I thought I just answered your question. That's the same question you just asked, which is if
and
it was in the emails, which is that the May 27th was an email.
Yes.
Okay, and the May 22nd was the tape from the Chili's restaurant, which, by the way, as I mentioned in my reply brief, is not before this court, and therefore we shouldn't even be addressing it because it wasn't introduced into evidence. But those two pieces of evidence came in during the defense case. Or later in the state's case, or the government's case, they came in after the judge had already allowed the prosecutor to stand up in opening statement and describe Devin and Brandy Coe seeing boylove.com on defendant's favorites list, and the Coes decided that he was a pedophile. It was too late to do
anything. It was
anything.
Too late.
And those two documents you're referring to, Your Honor, are denial documents. In those documents, defendant says, "I'm not a pedophile." So that's why he did not object. But it was a done deal.
It could certainly have been excised, and if
yes,
you know,
it should have been.
As you, counsel can ask for that.
I know that, but it was too late because it had already been put in. And see,
no,
he denies in that statement.
It's not put in. The prosecutor stands up and says it. In fact, if the prosecutor stands up and says it, and then it's not presented by way of evidence.
Well, then the Coes testified.
But that's when he should have objected.
Well,
that's when he should have objected, and that's when it could have been excised, or they could have been told not to talk about it.
And
if it doesn't come in, you can say, you know, the prosecutor stood up and promised you things at the beginning of the case. He said this would come in, and it didn't come in. Did you hear any evidence on this point? You can't avoid objecting to evidence because the prosecutor stands up and talks about it.
I agree, but there was a motion in limine. There was a 32-page opposition memo by the prosecution. There was a long hearing on this whole discussion. They readdressed the discussion on the day before the opening statement. They had exhaustively discussed whether or not these witnesses could testify in this way, and the judge had said, yes, they can. Now, if Your Honor is saying that a motion in limine is not good enough, you should object when the evidence comes in as well, I agree. I was not trial counsel. This isn't a perfect record. I assume what the defense counsel thought was, I've already objected until I'm blue in the face outside the presence of the jury. I don't want to emphasize this evidence in front of the jury, so I'm not going to object now. But she did make clear in a motion in limine.
You're over your time.
But I agree
that
the record could be clearer.
Thank you.
All right. Do I have any time left for rebuttal?
Not at all.
All right.
We'll see what you think.
Thank you.
Good morning, Your Honor. It's Marshall Silverberg on behalf of the United States.
Hi, Mr. Silverberg.
Hi. Is there a particular place that you would
is
like to
start? Is there anything you heard this morning that you don't think is adequately covered in your brief?
I would like to challenge a couple of their statements, if I might.
I guess the answer is yes.
Okay, yes.
We're not adequately covered in your brief. Okay, go
okay.
ahead.
First of all,
why don't you limit yourself only to those things?
Thank you, Your Honor. I'll do that. I'll be brief. Sufficiency of the evidence is not before this court. No Rule 29 motion was ever filed, no motion for judgment acquittal, either at the end of the government's case or at the end of the whole case. So that's not an issue. It was not raised in either the opening brief or the reply brief. So although there's been some discussion with opposing counsel, that was not an issue at court below or in the briefs. I never conceded, and I was the trial counsel, that the meeting at the mall was accidental. In fact, to the contrary, I said, we don't know how it happened because the defendant didn't say he intentionally met him there. But that is not the same thing as we were conceding that it was accidental. I mean, there's a million people on this island. And as the court has pointed out, the only person he was not supposed to be around lived a mile away from this mall. And the defendant had just been at that mall with the victim's mother a few days before. So we don't concede that it was accidental. The defendant knew that the parents went to the mall. He was just there 3 days before. He knew that the victim went to the mall because he had dinner there when he was here the year before. So, again, we never conceded that it was accidental. As to the whole issue that my opposing counsel was raising with the websites, and the email messages. At the final pretrial conference, before the trial even started, all those exhibits were placed into evidence. So we knew exactly, both Ms. Gray and I knew exactly when we went into opening statement, what exhibits were in evidence and what wasn't. So this wasn't something that was sprung on opposing counsel. This played into their theory of the defense. And the theory of the defense was that the reason the defendant came out to Hawaii was because he was concerned that there was this perception that he was a pedophile.
Tell me, Mr. Sommer, when, in your view, was the crime complete?
The crime was not complete until he got on the plane. It wasn't in Texas. It was
when the door closed and they say you can no longer talk on the cell phones, that's when the crime was completed. Right?
Or when the plane takes off from the ground, when you no longer can leave the plane.
Well, he can, you know, once the door closes, you can't leave the plane. Right. Yeah, I suppose if you make enough of a commotion, they might pull you off the plane. But once that door closes, it's gone. So at that point, the crime is complete.
Well, let me back off a second. That's the point. The intent part is complete, but you still have to actually violate the protection order. So if he got on the plane with the intent to violate the protection order and then came to Hawaii and changed his mind and never saw the boy, never ran into him, or he tried to see the boy and he never ran into him, there wouldn't have been a crime, because another element was that you actually violate the protection order.
I see. So you have to have the intent to, you have to travel into the state commerce with intent, and then you actually have to go ahead and violate the order.
Correct.
So the crime then wasn't complete in your view, all elements, until he grabbed that bike?
Well, it wasn't... When he came up to the boy at the mall, it wasn't complete until that point.
So when he sees him, what was the protective order, 100 feet or 100 yards?
It was 100 yards he followed.
Okay, so when he sees him 150 yards away, he's still not committed the crime.
Right.
It's only when he approaches past that bubble.
When he violates the protection.
And that's why you argue all this stuff is relevant. The mall, the conversation with the mother. Okay. I'm
right. I mean, those are elements of the crime. They
were the thing could have been tried without the emphasis on pedophilia, without all the pedophiles.
Well, I don't see how they could have made their defense without. Again, I never argued at all in opening or in closing that he was a pedophile. Not one word did I ever say that. The only reason it came up at trial was that the Coes had to explain why they got a protection order against
them. Why do they have to explain that? Why can't the judge simply give an instruction saying, you know, there was a protective order in place, there was evidence of protective order, you must decide whether there is a protective order in place, or maybe the party stipulated there was a protective order in place, and you are not to speculate as to why there was a protective order, whether this was a displaced parent, I mean, estranged parent who was denied custody, and there's some dispute between mother and father, let's say. I mean, that happens a lot of times. There's a big fight between mother and father, and one gets a protective order, one gets custody of the children, and in fact, and the jury can be told, don't speculate as to why. The only thing you need to know is that there is a protective order, and that's all. Case could have been tried that way, couldn't it?
And my guess is if the defense had accepted that, my guess, and I'm speculating, but my guess is Judge Aiken would have granted that. My point is they wanted to be able to bring out their defense, and their defense was the defendant got on that plane because he wanted to come out and correct the misperception in his view that he was a pedophile. And so you couldn't bring out, can't correct a misperception of people thinking that you're one thing, that you're a pedophile, without bringing in the other side of the coin. Did they think he was a pedophile? I don't know how you could bring it out one way without the other way.
Along those lines, what is the probative value of the name of the website, boylove.com?
Well, as Your Honor pointed out, it was in evidence already in terms of the exhibits that were stipulated to even before the trial began. And that is, it was
but
from
the question is, what is the probative value?
Probative value of it was to explain, I mean, if the, as opposed to just saying some questionable website. Well, if the defense had asked for, you know, to excise, as I think Judge Kuczynski pointed out, to excise the email in terms of the name, I mean, I don't know if you read the whole transcript I put in there. I actually tried to come up with another way of keeping in the name but trying to take away any kind of pornographic connotation, and that's in the transcript of it.
It's hard to do with that.
It's hard to do. Admittedly, it's hard to do.
The mind goes in only one direction.
That's right. But what the court did was it prohibited any mention from the content of the website. And that's really what the prejudice would have been. So the probative value was because in their own mind, the Co's own mind, the name of the website is what led them to have this concern that he might be a pedophile. If you don't know the name, you don't know how they came up with that concern.
Well, if he was a pedophile, it would be really probative that he would want to be around kids and that he was pursuing this relationship unnaturally and it wasn't accidental. The question is that more probative than it is prejudicial?
Except that I never argued, not once, that he was a pedophile. I mean, and...
Well, I don't think on the facts of this you would even have to. I mean, I think people would... I think the evidence did it for you. I don't think you had to say... I think you would never have to say the word pedophile for people not to think about it with all the evidence there.
And as you pointed out, you know, I mean, I have a 12-year-old son and a 14-year-old daughter, and someone has a favorites list, has this on their favorites list, there's no way they're coming near my kids. But these people were very trusting, and the defendant was the stepfather's cousin, Jim Co's cousin, and they took a precaution. They allowed him to come out anyway, despite knowing the name of the website. And what they did was they had Mrs. Co's father be there as a chaperone, so he would never be alone with the boy. But, you know, what you're doing is, I think, and forgive me, I don't mean to come across the wrong way, but, I mean, we're sitting here second-guessing, well, what we couldn't have done this, we could have done that. These are all things that were never raised at trial. They never raised the possibility of trying to excise the email message, excise the tape. What we wanted to do, and I think we had a right to do, and the defense lawyer admitted we had the right to do, was to put forth Mrs. Co's testimony, Mr. Co's testimony, in a comprehensible form. Why did they get a protection order in order to establish why they had the police try and arrest them afterwards? This is a cousin. I mean, we didn't want the jury to think that these were irrational people who were going off the wall, and a lot of the email messages from the defendant says, why are you doing this to me? You know, and those were all coming into evidence. So it would have been blatantly unfair to us, we think, if he could have gotten out through the email messages his theory of the case that they're irrational people without us putting forward the rational basis for their actions. I mean, as a prosecutor, you have to try and put forth a story. What happened and why did it happen in a way that will make sense to the jury? And if we had excised the name of the boylove.com totally, then the jury would have been wound up, would have thought, you know, are these people just off the wall? Why are they so hard and harsh on this defendant who no doubt was a very intelligent guy? This wasn't somebody that, you know, was running around with a stick or a gun. This was somebody that was a bright...
You know, I think you probably underestimate the jury. I think most jurors would realize that if some guy is obsessively wanting to see some 12-year-old kid, parents have very good reason to say no.
Yeah, but don't you think I think
you're probably selling the jury short. But in any event, is there anything further?
No, thank you very much.
Okay, thank you. We'll give you a minute for rebuttal, Mr.
Just briefly, I want to focus the court back on what the charge is. The charge is violation of a protective order. There's no, as I think Justice Callahan pointed out, there's no necessity to establish the reasons for the protective order. You don't have to prove that the parents were not irrational when they obtained it. The fact is, Judge Fong issued a protective order. It was violated. The defendant acknowledged violating it. There really wasn't an issue in terms of this particular offense. And that was discussed by Judge Aiken, acknowledged by Judge Aiken three or four times in the motion in limine. We are not here in a child molestation case. The government does not have to prove the reasons for getting the order. The issue of whether or not there was agreement to these documents before trial is not before the court. There's no transcript of that hearing. I was not the trial counsel, but neither were you, and I object to reference to the pretrial proceedings because they were not recorded. I think the fact is those documents came in after the Coase testified, And again, those documents included denials. I understand the court's concern about the implicit issues in this case. They were there without having to put in boylove.com. It wasn't necessary, and it pushed this jury over the top. There was plenty of evidence to establish that he was obsessive, and a very good reason for getting that order. If you look at Judge Fong's testimony, he doesn't deal with the boylove.com issue. All he dealt with is the obsessiveness, the repeated contacts. There was plenty enough to make the argument in a non-prejudicial way without it, which is why Judge Aiken said it was more prejudicial than probative, and then she changed her mind. Okay?
Thanks. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you for a fine argument, counsel. The case is argued and stands submitted. We are now going to be in recess for a few minutes while we reconstitute the panel, and we'll be back in not too many minutes, maybe 5 or 10.
All right.
Thank you.